what we end up doing in our careers or where life takes us. The way in which we grew up and the values we learned at an early age and hold dear will always guide the way. And that's certainly the case for fashion designer Gabriela Hurst, who grew up completely off the grid on her family's ranch in Uruguay. From learning how to live with very little, about how to make things by hand and care for and treasure well-made items, to seeing firsthand the impact on the earth from decisions we make, Gabriela's work today is no doubt a reflection of those things which were most important as a child. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. For today's show, I had the great pleasure to speak to Gabriela from her office in Manhattan. Her award-winning eponymous label was launched in 2015 with a focus on a new idea of luxury, crafting timeless functional pieces for both women and men. It's been an incredible journey in the industry, which started for Gabriela when she launched her very first label in Brooklyn back in 2004, this shortly after arriving in the United States. Candela began with just a few $100, which made t-shirts and silkscreen illustrations featuring a winged woman on top of a horse, which was based on a treasured photograph of Gabriela's mother. Here now is my conversation with Gabriela Hurst, where she began by telling me about her upbringing.
I grew up in Uruguay in South America, which is a small country between Argentina and Brazil. It's actually the size of England. But between these two giants, we are small. And I grew up in the middle of a ranch that my mother still lives there. And my family's been there for 170 years. My mother is still off the grid. So now we have solar panels. But when I was a kid, we just had a generator that would go up at night for maybe an hour and a half the most, because it was expensive. And then it was like dim lights from lanterns. And when I look back, it was a very romantic way to grow up, where it taught me so many things. First of all, it connects me to the earth. Even if I love cities, I love cities. I've been living in New York for 20 years, but definitely growing up there, you are connected with nature and you really understand that you belong to nature and nature doesn't belong to you. We're not apart. We are a symbiotic. You know, we're part of the animal kingdom. And so I learned about sustainability from a utilitarian point of view, because we had few things that were made to last many generations. Quality from a utilitarian point of view, because things were made well, because they needed to last. So it wasn't like quality from an opulence, it was quality from a craft and time and attention paid. That was one of the biggest influence, I think, in professionally speaking and in the way I carry myself. And I don't think I would have made it that long in New York if it wasn't for the fact that I carry those values. And then the one other thing I wanted to add to that, I think because I grew up riding horses at such a young age, which I don't remember when I was taught how to ride horses, when you're a small kid in a big animal, it builds your set of confidence, because, you know, there are moments that I felt like that at the pandemic, where a horse takes off and you're a small guy in that horse, you need to go with it or you die, basically. So you learn to have a certain relationship with danger. A lot of those things that I learned in the ranch came into practice in extreme situations. So I'm happy I had those lessons.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of that has translated into your work today. You talk about, obviously, sustainability, but just quality and craft and how things are made. And I know riding horses in nature is a big part of what you do. People can't see now, but you've got this incredible photo behind you of the horse there. I've seen this photo somewhere before, and this amazing jacket you're wearing, you look like you could go out for a ride right now. I would love to just hear about how you got into fashion and style and designing. How did that come into it? You talked about sort of living with very little and only what you need. But where does that start?
Well, for example, this is my father. I'm illustrating a picture of my father with a poncho. And there is a way gauchos dress that is really specific and beautiful. And there's a tradition to the way we dress. So that was one of the influences. Also my mom, which she didn't have a lot of clothes. But she had very well-made clothes, because you would make the clothes. There was no shop to buy, right? So you would make the clothes with the family seamstress, Tota. So my mother would choose the fabrics, usually European fabrics, and she would make her outfits. And, you know, this was an investment that you would do, for example, when you get married or when you have a certain age, or you wouldn't go shopping for clothes every week or month. It would be more of a specific time, you know, the ajuar, when you're getting married. And so it was really beautiful, well thought clothes for the occasions that you needed to wear. You know, in the case of my mom, was when she would go to the rural fair in Montevideo, you know, and we had like a bull or a horse to show, so you would dress up. So that type of activity. So I grew up with this contrast of very rustic, but then when you had to dress up, it was a very regal cleanup. You know, when you work close to the earth, you like to clean up.
You know, the way you describe sort of the design and sort of inspiration, it just reminds me of visiting sort of factories in different parts of the world that I've been to. And it's, I think today there's almost a disconnect in knowing how things are made. And a lot of people don't really understand what it takes to make things by hand. You will have seen that a lot growing up. You've described with your mother. That's obviously stayed with you.
Yes, it's stayed in a way that I still have an influence. Some of the pieces my mother had in my collections were, well, my first collection, I did a suit that she wore when she got married with my dad, which was this olive suit, military sort of blazer with a skirt that is still part of like the DNA of our brand, with this pleated in this beautiful wool. And she had the initials of my dad and her embroidered in like the bougon, like the type of military embroidered. And it was so beautiful and it's so present in my mind that it's clothes that makes you want to dream. And that is what drives me, to make things that are purposeful, that are just like, you just want to have it if it's gonna take room in this planet. And that is the key part, because we do not live in an endless cornucopia of natural resources. So I am religious about the concept of having few things that are good, that last you for the rest of your life. And I don't want to live any other way.
That's really interesting, because if you see any of the press around your label, there happens to be this conversation about the idea of luxury and sort of where you fit in that today, like as a player compared to historical fashion houses. I find that quite curious. How has that played for you? I want to come back and hear how you started the label, but this idea of luxury, I feel, keeps coming up in conversation about your label.
Well, I don't feel like what we do is really fashion. I feel like what we do is closer to cooking more than anything. I have friends that are chefs, and I find so much similarity in their work and our work, where it's about ingredients and how are they sourced. And it's the same. It's like we learned that there were food that looked good but didn't taste good. The same happened with clothing. There were things that looked good but didn't feel good. And your skin is your largest organ, and you're putting these things on top of your largest organ. I think we need to think about it. And so that is part of where I get very motivated, where it's the same as a chef. It's like, where's the ingredient? Why is we choosing this ingredient? What is the impact of this ingredient in the environment? What is the impact of this ingredient in the skin of our client? What does it make you feel? How it makes you think? So my recipe is very easy. It's ingredients, raw materials, where are they coming from? What's the impact? And the social component of who is making the clothes. Because I truly believe that whoever is in the process of our clothes making, those values, starting from me, get imposed in the garment. And so we really need to be aligned and making sure that our two pillars, which is long-term view and sustainability, are reflected there. So that's the challenge, and that's the beauty of it too.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You used the word utilitarian earlier as well. I see it sort of as the marriage of maybe that utility, but also a bit of beauty as well, and elegance. Does that definition work for you?
Yeah, I'll take utilitarian for sure, and elegance. I like all those words. I think even like this hat, right? It's a bucket hat. It's made out of a boucle cashmere. We did it to look like corduroy, and it looks like corduroy, but it's actually cashmere. And it took me a lot of time to develop, and nobody had done it before. You know, it fires me up to know that we did something nobody else did. For me, that's luxury.
Very interesting. I definitely couldn't pull off, but it's sitting very, very well on the top of your head today.
It's made in England. It's from Locke. It's a collaboration with Locke and Hatters, the oldest English hat makers.
Well, I'm sure you can find that perhaps over at your website. You mentioned the idea of having inspiration from doing something on your own, but you did work in the industry before setting out on your own. Talk to me about what it took to actually launch under your own name back in 2015 and why you thought that was a good time and place.
Well, it took a lot of failure, I would say, and doing mistakes and lessons learned. And I had started my own company in 2004 with two other partners in New York, still screening t-shirts in Brooklyn, like the image of my mom on a horse. That's like the Genesis photo. And we started with $700 each, so there was only one place we could go from there, and it was the contemporary price point. But we made the company go from zero to $1 million on the first year in 2003. It was that or I would go back to selling cows with my father. So it was like, this has to work. So that's how I maintain myself and support myself in New York with Candela, which was this kind of bohemian, a lot of embroidery, handmade, contemporary collection. But as I grew older, I had more and more desire and appeal to work with tailoring. I couldn't do tailoring in Candela because it was more a bohemian thing. And when my dad passed away and I inherited his ranch, where the real disconnect started to happen, where I felt there was a disconnect with what I was doing in New York and my upbringing and the type of product that I would like to make, because I was being pushed by department stores to lower price point, to lower quality, and that has an impact on the environment. The lower cost, somebody's picking up the tab, right? And it's the environment. And we keep on pushing that bill forward and it's accumulating. And so there was no way to do it but to start over. It was a really thoughtful process. Like Candela was really out of need. I need to support myself, what I'm going to create, right? And this one was really a, more of a thoughtful process of why does another brand need to exist in this world, of a really populated world? And it had to have value and it had to have purpose, and we had to make the product better than other people if we were going to take market share. So we thought and we looked where we wanted to do, and we it was an idea that was 2 years in development in my head, and then we start working on it on August 2014, and I actually became pregnant in September of 2014. So I gave birth to my youngest son and the company at the same time.
A legacy he'll carry with him forever, I guess.
And when he comes to the office, I tell the team, this is how old we are. So if we are acting a little crazy, that's because we are that old.
Ah, good way to put it, in the growth of business. That's very, very interesting. You know, it has been 5 years. You'll have come through Candela in the last company for more than a decade. So that's a lot of ups and downs. In the past couple of years, how do you feel you're on that track of the things that you do want to do? You talk about the different parts of the journey of a garment, let's say, the people that are making it, the people that are buying it, the purpose, what's the point of having it and making it. How are you feeling with your collections these days and how you sort of have been able to do that through your label?
It's really a great question because there's like different levels to it. The two pillars are long-term view and sustainability. So the way I think of business, and this was relevant to the pandemic, in the sense is I've been thinking 10 years from now, how we're gonna be doing business. I see the brand getting to a success 10 years from now because we control its growth. So it's a long-term view and sustainability two pillars. So from the long-term view perspective, I'm always thinking how we're gonna do business in a world where there's limited natural resources, there's water shortages. How are we going to be dealing with that? That's where my brain is, in the environmental crisis. So when the pandemic hit, I was already in crisis mode in my head. So a lot of the values did not change. That was interesting to see, where it's like, okay, we had to have short-term goals, like pay more attention to our digital and, you know, the sort of things that were obvious that we needed to fix. But the long-term view stays very stable. And I think that from the creative perspective, I feel that we are doing a very interesting evolution where the collections are being conceptualized more from a subconscious level. Especially the pandemic was very rich on that because you had so much input. It was such a stressful time. I like to say the brain was challenged. So we went more with the gut, right? We went more with the feeling. And I think that that manifested in the collection. Obviously, it takes a lot of consciousness to actually execute those ideas. But the channeling and conceptualizing of the collection in a very subconscious level, which is very interesting to me because I'm learning a lot through it too. And then from the quality perspective, I feel like we're still growing there. And from the environmental perspective, I think we're still growing there. I feel that we've come in a journey in 5 years where we've changed all our packaging to biodegradable, compostable. We've eliminated the use of plastic. We never really use any non-natural fibers, but we stay away from cotton. We use linen instead because it's less use of herbicides and pesticides. And when we use cotton, it's only on dead stock. So we measure the carbon footprints of our shows. We were the first ones to do it. We're lowering that. The garment journey, which is the method that you can track down every single ingredient of the garment that you buy from Gabriela Hearst. We launched that in the spring during the pandemic. But my bigger goal, which is what I want to achieve in next year, which is what is in my wish book, is to really be 80% non-virgin materials. To be really in a place where I am working with leftovers, but the highest quality leftovers. Because when you see our collection, you don't see that there is less than of quality. That's very important to me. So the goal is like highest quality possible with the lowest impact to the environment. And so that took a lot of years of relationships, of connecting where we source our materials. And in that, we're doing very good. What we're not doing very good at, which is I want to really push ourselves more, is in order to work the time schedule in a better way where we're shipping by boat, because we still freight by air. And the idea of using the non-virgin material, the dead stock, the repurpose, is that we're buying ourselves weeks from the mills. And that's something that production-wise, I feel we're still challenged in making sure we're shipping by boat. So that's where I need to buy 4 weeks on the chain to make sure that we're getting that. So that's where like we're doing good or we're doing bad.
That's really quite interesting. I'm glad you brought up the idea of using sort of dead stock and other materials or reusing materials in the collections. I feel like that conversation has really been accelerated in the last couple of months, and we're finally seeing, particularly in the luxury sphere, that being accepted. Let's say you hit the nail on the head when talking about people worrying about a level of quality, but now there's this ability, I think, to show, not in only in material science, but in an impactful way, that we can show that quality is right up there as well. And now you're seeing a lot of people upcycling and using these goods in their collections. That must be exciting for you, for someone that's always been talking about this.
Oh, it's very exciting. And I actually think that, you know, we did our first show with repurposed material, dead stock, in 2017. And people did not like to use that word next to luxury. It was like such a no-no. I got in trouble with a mill because I used that word. Now that mill sends me their dead stock all the time. So I'm so happy, because versus the food industry, not going to relate again, but it's true, there's a lot of waste in the food industry. 1/3 of all food in the world gets wasted at the cost of $1 trillion per year. And that is more herbicides, more pesticides, more usage of our land that we don't need, more usage of water, more use of pollutants. It's so wasteful in so many levels. But food, you know, has an expiration date. We're clothes, it doesn't matter if it was 3 years ago, the fabric was done. If it's a beautiful fabric, it's still in good quality if it was obviously, you know, maintained in the right space, right? So here's where creativity hits and taste hits, because you can repurpose thing and look like a hot mess, or repurpose thing and make it look really, really chic. And so that is where I find the creative challenge, because people say, don't you find it that it's really restrictive to work with? I'm like, I like the restriction. I like having to focus my creativity. I like to have parameters because it becomes more strong. It's like a laser. Not everything has to be custom, you know, like you can make what somebody else left over. What is the saying? Somebody's trash is somebody else's treasure. Like, absolutely.
That's very interesting. And you probably see the different walks of life in New York City being there. I'm just curious about you personally and how living in a big city and being based there sort of squares with the way you were brought up and how you sort of translate some of those values. Still to this day, I'm a person as well that grew up sort of half between the city and the countryside. How do you sort of find space for yourself to feel okay with living in a big city in the way modern life is?
Well, I love the energy of New York. I don't know if you can relate to that, but I've been thinking about that, especially during the pandemic. And I find the point where they convey the feeling, and it's the grit. Like, there's a grit to New York, and there was a grit of growing up in the ranch. Like, New York is not an easy place. Like, nobody comes to New York to just have a good time, you know, like live here. You accepts you or it spits you, you know, and it's like, that's where it's like the seduction. So that's how I'm very comfortable between the middle of nowhere and a city like New York. If you put me in the suburbs, I'm like, freak out. Like, I'm like, you need to get me out of here immediately. But between being in like this and the middle of nowhere, I'm good.
You know, you mentioned one of your stores in New York. You have, of course, one in London as well. Those have had some restrictions around them. They've been closed for a little while. How has that been for you? Obviously, that is an important part of showcasing what you do and what the brand is. That must have been difficult.
When we closed the stores, I was so delusional. We thought we were going to open up in like 4 weeks. You know, like, it's like a part of you, it's like, do not want to process it. So it was very challenging. But we pivoted and we've learned a lot of things, which the store in London, it's beautiful. It's sustainably made by Norman Foster. Then one in New York is beautiful as well, sustainably made. And I would literally live in my stores. Like, I would take a pillow and I would live in my stores. Like, no, there's pillows there. I don't even need to take them. And there's blankets. So like, I could live there. But then I was looking at my website. And I'm like, I wouldn't live there. So I knew we had to put some love and attention to the website. And that was one of the big instructional things where it's like, okay, this is a reality. What do we need to improve? But New York is definitely picking up. Still, it's like 50% down on the retail side compared to last year. But you see the month of September and October, like if you compare it month to month, it's 8% down than last year. So you're getting hopeful. And overall, the company, we pushed to do a resort collection, we pushed to do a men's collection, we just did spring. So the resort collection that we showed and sold this year, which was made in the pandemic and sold during the pandemic, did very well, did the same as last year. So overall, we're projecting to be 8% down from last year, which we're like so excited. But I'm like, it's still kind of sad that you're excited about that. But the good part of it is that we refocus immediately. We really were like, okay, if we're not going to hit the goal of the 30% growth this year, what are we going to want? And I'm like, I want the strongest team in the industry. So we really hold on to our employees. And as much as we could, we improved the team. We made ourselves better. We worked on ourselves. We never dropped the ball. So I'm very proud. I'm really, really proud of that commitment.
That's fantastic to hear about the team. You know, you mentioned sort of the digital and bricks and mortar divide that is so important to have both, we can say, for a brand today. I'd be remiss to not ask you about fashion shows, though. Obviously, this year we've seen a lot of different technique, we could say, platforms used to show off collections, obviously, because there aren't as many runway shows, certainly not a lot of people there to bring the buzz, we can say. So what's that been like, trying to think about how to showcase yourself and to showcase the new collection?
I have to tell you, I had no idea, because we showed in Paris for the first time. And for many reasons, one of the reasons was to have something for the team to be motivated as. Also, the idea of showing in Paris is always a dream. Also, is it really impactful, the carbon footprint, to ship from Italy to Paris versus Italy, the collection, to New York? So anyways, we decided to show in Paris. The Chambre Syndicale accepted us. I had no idea. I was happy the collection was going to be there. And if 10 people showed up, and my friend, which is a singer in Spain and a very popular one, Leiva, came and performed for the show. And it was my favorite show we've done. It was so beautiful. Like, so many people email me saying they've watched it and they cried. And we had the most beautiful show we've ever done. And my friend just like, his voice singing like goes straight to your soul. You can watch it, it's streaming. It really is an act of love when I saw that. And I feel that the sun came out. I told everyone the sun's gonna come out. They were projecting rain. It's like, don't worry, we're not coming to Paris for it to rain on the show. We had like both, you know, plans, and the sun came out. I remember we were doing fittings, shoots with Camila, the stylist, and then Jess, that does the casting, grabbed me and said, Gabby, come, and I come out. And it's like the sun is coming out, and it's like we're in the Beaux-Arts in Paris. Like, this is an incredible building. Like, the backstage, you die, all the sculptures. It's like, it's been a place for artists for hundreds of years, and it's a place where, like, their spirits of creativity were definitely blessing us in that moment. But it was really an experience, that show.
Sounds absolutely beautiful, and it couldn't have picked a better setting, really. Gabrielle, I've taken a lot of your time, and I do appreciate that, but we should land this plane, I guess, at some point. I'm just curious to hear about what's happening these days with you. Obviously, we've talked about the sustainability goals and what's happening there and where you want to take the brand, but what else might we see from you, and what's sort of filling your days right now?
Well, the elections, I think that the most sustainable thing you can do in the US is to vote. And there's only one party here that understands that climate change is real and it's man-made. And I think that that's really what is occupying my mind, and hopefully the results are going to be optimistic.
One last question I should ask is just around the climate in the United States. In the last little while, there seems to be a lot of energy. There's so much happening, lots of conversations, not only about sustainability, but also, of course, in race, just the state of our world and our politics as well. How does that leave you feeling right now, and what does that have you sort of thinking about?
Well, in New York, in my hometown, it feels like there is a renaissance for sure on the youth, that you're feeling them coming out, and there's a great energy that's populating the city right now. I've been here for 20 years, so I can perceive that. I'm thinking a lot about brain and brain perception and the three brains, because sometimes I'm thinking that why something so catastrophic like climate change is not really sinking in our brain. And I think there is something to do with our narrow pathways, where we are blind to it, or even simple things like, you know, watch the David Attenborough documentary, because I've read a lot of books about environmental science, and that documentary in 90 minutes, it synthesizes everything I've read and the solutions we need. So you don't need to read the books, just look at the documentary. You know, I was watching it with my daughters, and one of my daughters says, but it's only 1 degree. And that was like an issue, because our brain, when it thinks of 1 degree of warming or 1.5 degrees of warming, thinks it's not a lot, but it makes hell on earth. So I think a lot to do has to be with those simple brain learning things, where we think one is not a lot, but one is a lot. So my brain is thinking on how do we communicate these things that one thinks is not a lot, you know, like perceive easy concepts that we need to rejigger in the communication. That's where I'm at.
Well, very well said. And thank you so much for being a strong voice in that conversation around what needs to happen in our world, showing that not only through your work, but in everything you do. Gabriella, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for your time.
Fashion designer Gabriella Hearst speaking to me from New York City. You can visit her flagship stores on Brook Street in Mayfair here in London, or on Madison Avenue in Manhattan. Learn more as well at GabriellaHearst.com. My thanks to Gabriella and to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this episode. I'm Daniel Page. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.
The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 is brought to you in association with Longines. As part of this unique partnership, Longines bring you an exciting new show, The Spirit Lives On. The early 20th century was an era in which legendary aviators soared to new heights, performed daring stunts, and tested the limits of air travel. they helped propel the development of aviation, powering its transformation into the innovative industry we recognize today.
It was such a wonderful age to fly through. I was privileged to know all those gallant pilots, both men and women, and gifted designers.
Fearless pilots like Amelia Earhart, Wiley Post, and Eleanor Smith were willing to put their own lives on the line to quench their thirst for adventure. In The Spirit Lives On, we tell the stories of these people who dared to live out their dreams in the air.
I flew the Atlantic because I wanted to. If that be what they call a woman's reason, make the most of it.
You can find the latest episode of The Spirit Lives On every Friday. Search for The Entrepreneurs on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at monocle.com to download or subscribe now. Longines, The Spirit Lives On.